Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bryan, Judge Smith, Judge Flory, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding.
Good morning. You may have a seat. We are scheduled for three cases this morning. Marshall, will you call the first case, please?
Now calling case number A230330, Thomas Chazen, petitioner respondent, versus Kristen Chazen, appellant.
All right, thank you for your patience. I do have one opening request before you begin. I'm sure you both understand how this works. We have a podium in the middle. It goes up and down. If you need to adjust it, you'll be able to see the time remaining for your arguments. We have 15 minutes for each argument with a five-minute rebuttal for appellants. But my opening request is this. Before you begin, if you would take a moment to help us properly pronounce your name, and that of your client, and also let us know if you or your client have any preferences that we should know about when referring to you. And with that, Mr. Gainsley, you prepared to proceed?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Philip Gainsley for the appellant. Her name in the caption is Kristen Chazen. The decree changed her name to Kristen Briggs. And throughout this proceeding, I have referred to her as Kristen Briggs. And I will this morning, if that please the court. The party's marriage was dissolved in April of 2006, and the court entered judgment dissolving the party's marriage on April 21, 2006. And the decree awarded Ms. Briggs the amount of $163,000, and payment was due 30 days after the entry of the decree. There's no evidence that Ms. Briggs received the court-ordered funds, and that's not an issue on this appeal. The decree provides, however, interest at the judgment rate shall accrue on the balance due if the amount is not paid in full when due. While the court ordered the entry of the divorce judgment pursuant to the order, let judgment be entered accordingly, no one filed an affidavit to docket a money judgment until we did on April 1, 2022. And the court administrator docketed that money judgment, but without including, quote, interest at the judgment rate, close quote, as required by the decree. And then in July of 2022, Ms. Briggs domesticated her judgment in Florida, Mr. Chazen's state of residence. There, he voiced no objection to the Minnesota judgment or to its domestication in Florida. He actually stipulated to the withholding of funds with no objection, and those funds remain segregated today. As we argued before, he waived any objection he might have had. Nevertheless, in January of 2023, Mr. Chazen moved the court for its order vacating the money judgment docketed on May 4th, 2022. And the court granted his motion, saying simply, far more than 10 years have passed since April 21, 2006. The court did not address any of the other issues before it, including Ms. Briggs' motion for the non-pro-tunk order, presumably as moot, or for the need-based attorney fees. The only findings made by the district court was a history of filings in this proceeding. This morning, we're asking this court to reverse the trial court's order with instructions to redocket the money judgment, but with interest as required by the decree, and to award the need-based attorney fees. I hasten to add that Mr. Chazen spills a lot of ink saying Ms. Briggs was paid the amount due, but there's no finding or evidence to that effect, and that's, as I said earlier, not an issue for appeal. The only issues before the court are the timing of the money judgment and Ms. Briggs' motion for an award of need-based attorney's fees and for the non-pro-tunk order. In docketing her money judgment, Ms. Briggs is not enforcing the divorce decree entered in 2006. The docketed judgment is entirely separate and distinct from the judgment dissolving the party's marriage. This is not a situation where she's attempting to renew a judgment, as in the Klingelhutz case. This is not a situation where she attempts to do discovery 10 years later, as in the Dalseth case. In the Klingelhutz case, Mr. Chazen relies on language in the precedential, non-published opinion, quote, because appellant did not commence this action within 10 years of when judgment was entered, we affirm the Rule 12 dismissal of this action to renew a judgment. This is not an action this morning to renew a judgment. And the same with the Dalseth case. Appellant attempted discovery after 10 years there. And the issue was whether enforcement of the underlying judgment was barred by the 10-year statute of limitations. And to repeat, our matter is not for the enforcement of the existing judgment. Our matter involves the docketing of a money judgment, not the enforcement of a divorce judgment.
Is there, counsel, is there any time limit in your view when there is a judgment, a J&D, that's entered, a judgment entered?
The answer is no.
Even if that is no longer an enforceable judgment, you're saying that a party 10, 15, 20 years down the road could nevertheless docket that judgment and then take further proceedings to recover on the obligation established by that judgment?
I didn't understand your premise. You said even if it's not an enforceable judgment, even if it is an enforceable judgment.
I'm sorry. I guess, would you agree that if this was not a docketing case, but just simply judgment was entered in the year 2006, and in the year 2026, someone brought an action to enforce that judgment, would you agree that the statute of limitations bars that action?
No.
Oh, so what is the statute of limitations? What does
the statute of limitations?
I'm saying there's no docketing involved in that one. There's just an enforcement, no docketing.
Oh, 10 years.
Yeah, so the statute of limitations would bar
enforcement
of that judgment.
Yes.
But I think your argument is, okay, well, that doesn't have to do with docketing. You can docket in a judgment just, I guess, without, like, ad infinitum?
Yes.
Okay. And even though the obligation that docketing would be serving you to, like, satisfy, right, by going after property to satisfy that judgment, it's unlimited. So even though the underlying judgment has timed out for direct enforcement, you can docket as long as you want.
Yes, and that's not the answer the court wants to hear, but let me explain. Mm-hmm. We do encourage finality. The Klingelhutz case says that in dictum. By the way, it is totally dictum. The paragraph begins, even if we were to dot, dot, dot. There's two competing interests, it seems to me, here. One is the finality of judgments, finality of litigation, but the other is the enforcement of the party's rights. In this instance, neither party is prejudiced by the time Ms. Briggs docketed the judgment. Mr. Chazen has had the use of the $163,000, invested it, did whatever he did, for all this time, so he's not out anything by pursuing this. And Ms. Briggs is entitled to the enforcement of her judgment. She's not out anything. She's the judgment creditor.
Right. Well, she wouldn't be able to enforce it but for the docketing. I mean, you've agreed to that.
Oh, correct.
So at some point, even if you think you have a right to something, if you don't assert that within a statute of limitations period, it's lost, right?
And that statute in this instance begins upon the docketing of the judgment.
It does say, and I think this is the pertinent language, that final sentence there, quote, the judgment survives and the lien continues for 10 years after its entry.
Yes.
It doesn't say docketing in that sentence. So it survives 10 years after entry. You don't dispute it was entered in, 2006?
I agree with that. I think that statute is not entirely clear, but the statute does talk about two different things.
Well, is that sentence ambiguous? If so, why? And I'm not sure. Go ahead. I have a follow-up, but go ahead.
I agree. I mean, it's clear that the statute says that the judgment of divorce, the decree, lasts for 10 years. It doesn't talk about...
It says every judgment requiring paying of money shall be entered by the court, and at the end it says the judgment, presumably talking about every judgment requiring payment of money. The judgment survives for 10 years after entry. So is that unclear? If so, what is the ambiguous term there?
I would have preferred that it said entry or docketing, but it doesn't. I understand that. But we're not enforcing that judgment. We're not enforcing the judgment that is entered. We've docketed the judgment, and that begins the 10 years.
So is your argument then there was no entry of judgment, that there needs to be a new entry of judgment?
A new docketing of judgment. There was the entry of judgment. That was the judgment dissolving the party's marriage. We're here this morning about the docketing of the money judgment that the court ordered with interest.
I think the problem, and I mean precisely the problem that Judge Ryan is, the sentence that he's referring to, the judgment survives and the lien continues, which comes from the docketing, for 10 years after its entry. I mean, its entry, do you think its, I mean, its refers to the judgment. That's what gets entered, right? Are you trying to argue that its, that somehow the 10 years, does 10 years matter at all for the, does the docket have an expiration date?
No. Okay. That goes back to the question you asked me before.
Well, I said when you can get a docketed, when you can docket. But now I'm asking, do you think a docketed judgment lasts forever? What its entry seems to refer to, and that's what we decided, I think, in our non-presidential decision, that its entry refers to the entry of judgment because...
It refers to judgment.
Judgment.
Yes.
Okay, so you agree with that. So then it seems like the lien continues for 10 years after the judgment is entered. You didn't even... Not only did it not continue, the lien wasn't even asked for more than 10 years after the judgment was entered.
Yes.
It seems your argument is that at any point, even after 10 years, a party can redocket a judgment and sort of restart that 10-year period. If that's the case, if that is what you're arguing, then what effect does this 10-year period ever have? It seems kind of meaningless, right?
I respectfully disagree. We're not redocketing anything. We're docketing. The judgment's been entered. Now we are docketing. We didn't have to docket. And as a matter of fact, one of the cases said that. This could go on forever. We don't have to docket. As a matter of fact, it wasn't until she was alerted to the fact that she was entitled to this money that she docketed. Docketing is optional, but you better do it to collect your money. But you don't collect your money. You don't recover. There is no lien. Upon the entry of the judgment, you need to docket the judgment. And that was on the judgment roll of the district court administrator. Mr. Chazen would have the court believe that if the court grants our motion, Ms. Briggs would have a, quote, windfall. And I need to ask, what windfall? She was entitled to this money. He's sat on this money all this time. What's the windfall? She's entitled to the money. She's entitled to the interest on the money. That's clear. The Riley case that's quoted in the Zephyr case really defines that very well. Of course she's entitled to the interest on it. She just wants her judgment. Nothing more, nothing less.
So let me add, in reviewing judgment and decrees on these that have marital equalizer payments in them like this one did, I've sometimes seen language right in the judgment and decree that says one party will pay the other party a marital equalizer payment within 30 days. And if it's not paid within that paid, a money judgment shall be docketed in that amount, starting so that you don't run into this type of an issue. Does that factor into our consideration here?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think Referee Piper's language was pretty close to what you said. If it's not paid, she shall have judgment at the prevailing rate of interest, words to that effect. So that is awarding her the judgment. I just had to docket that judgment. The district court administrator had no trouble with that. No, I mean, there was no issue. Didn't have to go to the chief judge of the clerk of the court saying, is he entitled to do this? I mean, it was It was natural. It was the natural outcome. Yes, it was late, and the reasons for its tardiness are irrelevant, although I did supply the court with the reasoning. Entry and docketing are not synonymous. The rule that I think we're talking about, Rule 5801, says a district court shall direct the appropriate judgment to be entered on an order for relief other than money or costs. That's 5801, and that's entry. We docketed the money judgment, and the court entered it initially. We caused it to be docketed. And as the OP case says, the law does not specify any time limit to enter, to docket a money judgment. That's the OP case at page 194.
Can I ask then, just getting back to even if you say there's nothing that precludes docketing a judgment more than 10 years after its entry.
I am saying that.
Then what still do we do with the statute that I think you're relying on of 548.09, that the lien only continues for 10 years after the entry of judgment? I mean, maybe you docket it, but how is there still a lien? Which is what you need, right? I mean, that's your goal, is to get a lien by virtue of
docketing. No. This is not a case about lien. Counsel makes that point, too, about this not being a case of a lien. Liens involve real estate, and that's what this statute addresses, is whether the judgment is a lien against real estate. And that's why it goes on to say, and if there's a judgment from a foreign county, from a different county, it's got to be docketed in the county of record, from the county of record to another county. That's the lien. We're not talking about a lien here. We're not talking about a lien against real estate. My time is being limited here, and
does 548.09 matter to you at all? In other words, do you think it's, if I may just ask that, presiding judge, is that a statute you rely on, or do you just think it's not relevant at all?
Well, I think it's relevant because it talks about judgments, but I'm not relying on it.
Okay.
Because this is not a real estate matter. I want to talk for a minute. Obviously, if the court finds in our favor, I think it's
Mr. Gainsley, your time has expired for your principal argument, so if you want to wrap up, and then you can address whatever.
I'll wrap up now, and I'll save it for my 5 minutes. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ben Court. I am counsel for Mr. Chazen in this matter. With me at counsel table is my colleague, Casey Phillips Toffick. Also helping us out on this, on the briefing and preparing for this argument, is one of our summer associates, Harshita Kaladindi, here behind us. And we've got some of our summer associates here today. And I welcome them to learn from, hopefully, my mistakes.
Mr. Court, I don't know if you intended to leave the podium where it's at, but if you wanted to adjust it, I wanted to make sure you knew about that, too.
There we go. It's on the right side in the federal courts. Here's at base the issue. There is simply zero authority to support appellant's main argument here that the statute of limitations did not begin to run until the judgment was docketed in 2022. It is undisputed and very clear from the record that the judgment was entered and placed on the judgment roll on April 21st, 2006, pursuant to the plain language of Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 5801. That constitutes the entry of judgment. From there, going to 548.09, the statute is very clear that the judgment survives for 10 years.
Right, but you said it was included in the roll?
Yes, it's
what
right on the
more
decree.
Had to happen for it to be docketed?
Well, pursuant to Minnesota Statute 548.09, docketing, which is completely optional and unnecessary from an enforcement perspective, you have to file a judgment debtor identification to docket it. But this is the main problem with appellant's argument, is they have, I think, intentionally confused the concepts of entry of judgment and docketing of judgment. Think of it like a note and mortgage on your home. The note is the entry of judgment. That says how much it is, what the terms are effectively, and it starts the enforcement time. That's entry of judgment. Docketing of judgment is like your mortgage. Its sole purpose is to be a lien on real property in the county where that judgment is docketed, which is completed by filing a judgment debtor identification. You can't foreclose on a mortgage without having something owed under the note. That's the problem here. The judgment, which was 16 years old at the time of docketing, had expired. It's dead. It doesn't exist anymore. So docketing certainly serves no practical purpose, because 548.09 clearly says that the lien survives for the same period for 10 years from the entry of judgment. It's coexistent with the entry of judgment. That timeline runs concurrently. They're together. So again, you can't foreclose on a mortgage without something owed, but you can certainly have something owed, and you can certainly enforce a note without needing a mortgage. And that's really what's going on here. Opposing counsel tries to frame this as a docketing issue. This is not a docketing issue. This is an enforcement issue. He has garnished my client's bank accounts in Florida, where he resides, and there is money sitting in escrow right now. If this case somehow got reversed, they would get the money. This isn't about docketing. This isn't about a lien. This is a convenient argument that is being made to try to get around what I think is the plain language of the statute. This is, do not be fooled. This is an enforcement case. They are trying to recover $162,000 plus 20 years of interest, or 16 years of interest, on that judgment.
Can I ask, so, I mean, totally understand your what your argument about what 548.09 is for. You know, it's to create a lien right against real estate.
Correct.
Right, by docketing it. Explain to me how this results in a garnishment of assets in Florida. Like, just tell me more about that. I mean, it's not real estate thing. Is it because there's just a what happens?
What happened here is after 16 years after the entry of the judgment on April 21st, 2006, the appellant files a judgment debtor identification. It appears that the district court administrator makes a mistake, re-enters that judgment, and dockets that judgment. Appellant then runs to Florida, where my client now resides, domesticates that judgment there, and immediately files garnishments on my client's account.
Domesticates the judgment.
He domesticated the judgment in Florida. So
again, you said re-enter the judgment, are you speaking literally, or is it just a judgment?
It's unclear in my mind what the district court administrators did here. At base, though, it was a mistake.
Okay, because they don't necessarily fall off the rolls by judicial act or by court action, sort of sua sponte. I presume it's more a statute of limitations if someone tries to act.
Exactly, and that's why Rule 60 exists here, so that we can bring a motion to have this judgment declared void, and that's in fact exactly what we did. And in fact, the district court granted that motion consistent with existing law. So there just is not a mechanism here for appellant to continue to collect on this judgment 16 years later. And I think what is very intellectually dishonest about the argument that is being made is opposing counsel is trying to have it both ways here, Your Honors. He is trying to say, on the one hand, the survival under 548.09 and the statute of limitations in 541.04 doesn't apply here, so he can continue to exercise whatever rights his client feels she is entitled to try to collect this judgment, notwithstanding the fact that it's 16 years old and that the statute of limitations did not run. It continues to survive. But on the other hand, he's also arguing that he's entitled to judgment, I'm sorry, entitled to interest from the time the judgment was entered in 2006. You can't have it both ways. He can't, on the one hand, say, because you can't get interest in a judgment that is not entered. And a judgment, once it's entered, only survives for 10 years. So he can't have it both ways. So that is our main problem with his interest argument, is it doesn't work. Once a judgment no longer survives, it's unenforceable, and any attempt to try to revive it by claiming interest was due on it, by claiming this is a docketing issue, et cetera, is just not supported by any existing law or any extension of existing law here. And that is why, as a practical matter, one of the arguments that we've made with regard to the attorney's fees request is, one, this is not a family law issue. We argued this in our brief. The case law is clear that under Nelson v. Quaid, this is a property settlement issue.
Did want to turn to this. So is there any case law that you could point to that involves a docketing only of judgment, not some other type of enforcement action, but just docketing a judgment in a family law matter in that same file, you know, it's in a family law case, all you're doing is taking that judgment and then docketing, that is not a proceeding under 518, Chapter 518 or 518A?
I believe there was another case we cited in our brief besides the Nelson case. It was from 1986, I believe, is a Minnesota Court of Appeals case. But that case and the Nelson case from 87, I would argue, Your Honor, that for the last 30-plus years, the courts have been clear that property settlement issues in divorce cases are normal debtor-creditor actions. This does not involve maintenance. This does not involve
Well, for continuing jurisdiction, but I'm wondering for the attorney's fees. I wondered if there's anything just like this. I mean, because here's my concern. It's like, well, a couple things. And I don't know if you addressed the Brodsky case at all, but that's a case that involved conduct-based fees in an ancillary proceeding, not the Chapter 518 proceeding, which, you know, we held were available, conduct-based fees, as a 518 proceeding. But I mean, you're slicing off. You're saying that, okay, you have there's a judgment in a dissolution case under 518. It has a bunch of different things: spousal maintenance, child support, property settlement. That, with respect to attorney's fees, part of that judgment, that dealing with property only, if I'm understanding you right, if you docket that judgment, et cetera, and it relates to the property part, well, that's no longer a 518 proceeding, although the other things in that judgment would be. It just seems that you would have to, one's a proceeding under 518, even though you're talking about the same judgment when you're trying to enforce it, and another one is not. That seems very complicated if you're trying to enforce multiple things in a judgment, for example. It just seems to create a unnecessary confusion and also maybe not a good idea. I mean, if they all arise from the same J&D, why not?
So two responses to that, Your Honor. One, there is zero precedent for the conclusion that appellant would like this court to take, which is that any matter that starts as a family law matter or as a marriage dissolution matter is forever, in every aspect of it, is forever a family law matter. This is not a core family law issue. This is
I think we should be more precise. Whatever you're characterizing that argument as is maybe a little hyperbolic. Then my question is a docketing of a family law judgment no longer? Just that's all we're at. We're not in an enforcement action, for example, or we're not even in a separate action to renew a judgment. That's a different question. What we're dealing with right now is simply docketing the judgment. So speak to that.
Certainly. First of all, to just go back to what I said, this is not about docketing a judgment. This is about enforcing a 16-year-old judgment. So that is, I think, a different issue. Docketing, as I explained earlier, is a lien mechanism. So that's not what this is about. That's not what the appellant is trying to do. Second.
But did it bring an enforcement? You're characterizing the Minnesota action as a, I mean, this came up as a motion to vacate.
Correct.
The judgment.
But okay. The way I'm characterizing it, Your Honor, is they are trying to collect on this judgment. Sure. That is enforcement. That is not docketing. Docketing is just, again, to serve as a lien on real property. Now, enforcement would be when you try to foreclose on that lien. And that, but that's not what's happening here. They have these funds garnished, and they are trying to capture these funds. I would say the great weight of, in the reading of the Nelson case of Minnesota 550.02, is this is a debtor-creditor action like any debtor-creditor action. This arises on a judgment. Just because that judgment, it's a money judgment, just because that judgment arose initially from a dissolution proceeding does not necessarily make every action that follows a family law issue. And second, to answer your question from earlier, it is required under Minnesota Statute 518 that the court find that the proceedings are being pursued in good faith. And I would argue, as we've put in our brief, that this is not being pursued in good faith because Minnesota Statute 548.09 and Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure 5801 are absolutely clear and are absolutely fatal to the entire underlying proceeding that has been brought by the appellant here. So this, as I said earlier, this is not consistent with the law. And frankly, it's not consistent with even a reasonable extension of the law. The statutes couldn't be more clear that from entry of a judgment, which happens when it's entered by the court and placed on the judgment roll, which happened here on April 21, 2006, that's the entry of judgment. He has 10 years from that time unless the judgment is renewed. The judgment here was never renewed.
So if it was renewed, we wouldn't be here today?
Correct.
They could be doing exactly what they're trying to do here today?
That's correct.
So the failure to renewal is fatal to appellant's case here?
Absolutely. Absolutely correct.
Are there factual findings? The problem is, I think, with the argument you're making now about the good faith, the district court made no factual findings whatsoever about attorney's fees.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And the way that opposing counsel attempts to sort of shift the burden on that issue is to say, well, the court made no findings that it wasn't in bad faith, but the problem is if the court is going to grant this, it has to make findings that it was in good faith. So I would say the lack of findings on that issue are implicit that it was not in good faith.
Right. You have to find an implicit finding. So you have to argue there was a finding and it's implicit. Because we don't normally make findings up here of good or bad faith that a district court didn't make.
In order for the appellant to prevail on that argument, they would have had to establish that the court made findings that it was in good faith and that it met all of the other statutory criteria. I guess what I'm saying...
We've reversed other matters if a district court doesn't make factual findings that it needs to make, I don't think an appellant to secure a remand needs to prove what those factual findings must be. I mean, we remand for factual findings when they need to be made and they weren't made, right?
And I would take a step back and say no findings are necessary here because the first issue, which the court found in our favor, that this was a 16-year-old judgment that they were trying to enforce, is not an action in good faith and is not connected to the family law case. I don't believe any findings are necessary to establish those points, Your Honor.
Do you believe that the affidavit and materials that accompany the request for attorney's fees sufficiently address the financial requirements?
No, Your Honor. I don't.
Are you making that argument as well, or is that something that you just decided not to make? You're focused more on the implicit or maybe obviously implicit finding that the district court has made?
Your Honor, we are focused primarily on the fact that opposing counsel and his client are attempting to enforce and collect on a 16-year-old judgment, which is completely unsupported by any existing or any reasonable extension of the law.
I guess that doesn't really address the question. So when it comes to the attorney fees request in particular, it's not simply just good faith, bad faith. There are also some initial requirements that a party would have to either prove or at least swear to. And I didn't see any argument in the brief that was deficient But it sounded kind of like in your argument to us just now that you were saying there are these other statutory considerations that weren't established either. So that's why I'm asking, are you in fact making that argument even though it's not in the brief, or is that something that you understand given the way we address these issues that it's you're not actually making that argument today?
I guess the way I would phrase it, Your Honor, is we didn't have a chance to test the veracity of the statements in those in that affidavit because we didn't have an opportunity for discovery. But I don't think that's an issue this court need get to because I don't think they've met the statutory threshold in a first instance.
Okay. Are there other questions from the panel?
No,
all right, thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I was going to leave off with what ultimately the court proceeded with, and that was the award of attorney fees. First, let me respond to the court's question about whether they argued anything about my affidavit pursuant to Rule 119 or my client's affidavit of need, and the answer is zero. They argued nothing about that. They didn't challenge it. They didn't suggest it was inappropriate, in error. That just was, they've conceded that in their briefing. I want to answer the court's question, though, about garnishment in the main action. Under the Uniform Enforcement of Judgments Act, once a judgment is domesticated in the foreign state, that foreign state can take whatever action is necessary, and garnishment is clearly allowed. It's allowed in this state when we import a judgment from another state, and it was allowed in there. That garnishment was not a part of what we did here. Our garnishment was the result of a judgment that was entered. We don't have pre-judgment garnishments in this state anymore. It's post-judgment garnishment. Counsel did not, Mr.
Chase. Can I ask you this? Without the docketing, could you have domesticated that judgment in Florida, a judgment that was not docketed and was 16 years old?
I suppose the judgment of divorce could have been domesticated in another state. I'm not sure for what purpose. We domesticated it in Florida because we have a money judgment, and we found that the only assets of the judgment debtor were in Florida. So that's where we chose to domesticate it. Did that answer your question?
I guess without the docketing, would you have been able to garnish anything in Florida on a 16-year
no.
Minnesota judgment?
No.
Okay.
No.
Thanks.
As a matter of fact, I made a note to myself here. The garnishment was pursuant to the judgment, so that answered that question. The argument that counsel makes about interest was not argued in its briefing and, frankly, should be disregarded here. It's important, though, as the courts pointed out, that if you're going to deny attorney fees, the statute says findings must be made. The exact words of the statute are something like, quote, provided it finds. That means making findings.
Is that 518.14?
Yes.
So how does that even apply? Because you've told us you're not attempting to enforce a judgment entered under Chapter 518. Why would 518.14 even enter our discussion if you're not attempting to enforce a judgment entered under that?
Well, I think
the judgment decree was entered under 518, Chapter 518, right?
Right.
And so how does it even apply? You've told us you're not attempting to enforce that judgment.
The two cases that are cited by counsel don't even suggest that. The two cases, to answer the court's question, say it's nothing different from a commercial judgment, creditor and debtor. But it doesn't say it's removed from family court. It doesn't say that family court no longer has jurisdiction. It's just saying that relationship is commercial. But it certainly doesn't say, nor was it even asked to say, nor was it even addressed, that 518.14 wouldn't be applicable. I don't... I unless I'm muddling the court's question, I don't see where 518, where family court loses its jurisdiction. This has been a family court matter throughout, and from the title of the case to the family court judgment to throughout, it's been family court. When the court is told to draw findings by statute and our case law, and as the court says, this court remands frequently for further findings, it doesn't mean by implication, it doesn't mean by inference. The court has to draw findings, and the reason the court has to draw findings is that this court has to have a clear understanding of the ground or basis of the district court's decision. I'm quoting many cases of this court. Implicit does not provide such grounds or bases. The factual findings must be articulated. And I hasten to add, it's irrelevant that Ms. Briggs didn't succeed below. Need-based attorney fees are allowed whether or not the applicant for those attorney fees is successful. I'm asking the court to reverse the district court, reinstate the judgment with the proper amount of interest, and to award need-based attorney fees. Thank you, Your Honor. Just standing here to make sure that there's no questions of me.
No questions.
All right. Thank you very much. I want to thank the parties for their arguments, and they're both written and oral. We will issue an opinion within our 90 days. Thank you. Have a nice day.